Now in the sixth section of what I've entitled Years of Prosperity, which are the years of Shlomo HaMelech's success, the years of material and financial economic success of Bnei Israel under the rule of Shlomo HaMelech. Let's try to put this in perspective. What we're going to focus on tonight is the topic of did Shlomo sin? Complex topic because it takes a little bit of reading of the Psukim and beyond to appreciate this. Let's start at the very beginning. So we saw last week that Shlomo HaMelech had done a number of things which are technically not really the right thing to be doing. So he, on the one hand, we saw that he started accumulating gold, silver. He started horse trading. He started getting involved with Egypt and having hordes and hordes of horses. Then also we saw that when it came to relationships as well, there was complexity. Shlomo HaMelech started married many women, married a number of women who were of non-Jewish descent as well. And we saw the complexity of that. So now it reaches its pinnacle, its apex in our learning this today. And today we're going to be focusing on the midsection of Perek Yud Aleph, just to see, have a roadmap of where we're coming and going to this week. We're going to focus on the sins of Shlomo HaMelech. Next week we're going to focus on the repercussions, sort of the dissidents who form out of this. So that'll close the series. So we're really at the end of the series right now. That's going to close Perek Yud Aleph. So we're doing the central section of Yud Aleph today and the last section of Yud Aleph next week. And here's what we hear. So after he has all these wives, he marries all these women from all different territories, from Tzidon and the Chittim and the Ammonim, Mitzrayim, all these different relationships, which are very complex. We're told an interesting thing here. So let's take a look at these four psukim together. We're told in Pasuk Zayin to Yud, Az Yivneh Shlomo Bama, he built a Bama. What's a Bama? A Bama is usually an altar of sorts. In the days before the Beis HaMikdash, a Bama would be an altar. Now, I know we have got certain pictures in our minds, but, you know, in the good old days, a Bama just meant a pile of stones upon which you would sacrifice things. So, like, you know, I always remember the first time I went to one of these archaeological ruins, and they said, oh, this is such and such a Bama, and it's like, you know, like a little pile of pebbles. It's like, but yeah, that's what it was. They would gather together the stones, that would be the altar upon which they would be sacrificing. Lichmosh Shikutz Mo'av. It was built for Kamosh. The God or the Shikutz is, so to speak, the Tanakh's way of denigrating the description of their God. Bahar on the mountain, Asher al-Pnei Yerushalayim. So facing Jerusalem, can you imagine this? They have facing Jerusalem and the adjacent mountaintop is a Bama, an altar for Kamosh. Ulamolech Shikutz b'nei Ammon, and goodness, the Molech himself, the Ammonite God. And by the way, you know, we have archaeological ruins where we can read about these gods very clearly. You know, there's what's called the Mesha Stele from a period which is a little bit later on in Melachim, with Mesha the king of Moab, and he describes, you know, Kamosh is their central god. Molech was a Phoenician, is Ammon, but it was really across the Middle East. So much so that the Torah goes out of its way to warn us against giving our children to Molech. The primary service would be passing children over the fire. And, you know, in Phoenician ruins, they found numerous urns which had on them the Ugaritic inscription MLK, not to be confused with Martin Luther King, but it was actually the word for Molech, meaning they burnt their children to this. This is, you know, this is terrible stuff. And here it is, this is not outside, this is inside Jerusalem. I mean, it's just hard to even imagine. And he did for all his wives. They were all sacrificing to their gods and their foreign gods. And Hashem got angry with Shlomo. He clearly diverged from the path of Hashem, who appeared to him twice. When were these two times that he appeared to him? So we actually studied both of those periods. The first is the beginning of Israel in Givon, where he sacrificed the Bama there before the Beis HaMikdash. And he had this vision, which is where he asked for his Chachma. The second one was at the end of the building of his house and the Beis HaMikdash. HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared to him again and gave him a conditional success, bracha. And so after all of that, after God has appeared to him explicitly two times in his life, he left him. He didn't listen. He didn't abide by what Hashem explicitly told him. So this is what we have over here. I mean, it's just so hard to read what's going on over here. One thing that we didn't have a chance to look at last week, I think, is really relevant and significant when it comes to this is is a Meir Shiloach. The Meir Shiloach was a very fascinating individual. He was the Rebbe of Ishbitz. Ishbitz is offshoot of Kotzk, and just had a really very beautiful Kiddushim across Tanakh. And in this section, he says a very beautiful thing, and we talked about this last time, so I wanted to just append this on to what we studied last time. And he turns this into a very Kabbalistic perspective. It's very interesting. And last week we looked at the Chida, coming not from the Hasidic roots, but from the Sephardic roots, who had talked about the idea of Shlomo HaMelech trying to take out the Nitzotzos HaKadosh, or the level, so to speak, the holiness out of the klipot, of the negative, the Tumah, which is found among the nations. So the Meir Shiloach takes it one step further. He says, Ki kol koach ulmos biyoser, so in a certain sense, he was marshalling the powers of those nations by his marriages with all of the princesses of these nations. The primary, so to speak, hallmark expression of the Moabites was eating and drinking. The Ammonites were those who were predominantly lusting people. Sidonim who koach amamon, the Sidonians, the Phoenicians were those who treasured money. Chetiot bekoach gvura. What Shlomo HaMelech was trying to do was trying to marshal each of those forces by inputting, so to speak, having a relationship and having a connection to each of those and the influence that would yield in each of those. Whether successful or not is what Tanakh is giving us a commentary on. I mean, I just thought this was a fascinating perspective. He actually focuses on what each nation metaphysically represents. let's actually read the next section of Pesukim before reflecting on these next sources. And here we're told that now HaKadosh Baruch Hu actually calls Shlomo out explicitly in Source 5. In the next three Pesukim, Hashem actually goes out of his way and says, you did wrong. You didn't listen to me. You didn't abide by the commandments. I will rip away the kingdom from you, the kingship from you, and I'm going to give it to your servant. The word karat, tear, is really significant. We'll see in the imagery which occurs next week the significance of ripping. Ripping is an important thing. If we go back to Shaul HaMelech, when there was a moment where Shaul HaMelech lost the kingship, that was when ultimately he's running after Shmuel HaNavi, and he, in Perek Tezvav in Shmuel, he grabs onto the cloak of Shmuel and it rips, and he says, just as the cloak ripped, so too your kingdom will be ripped from you. Here the same thing seems to be happening to Shlomo to a certain degree. And we're going to see how ripping is going to play into the prophecy of splitting in a moment, and why that's significant. That's for next week. But in the meantime, there is an exception. He says, "Ach, one, so to speak, consolation is it's not going to be during your days, leman David avicha, because of David your father. Miyad bincha ekra'ena, I'll tear it from your son," which is a consolation, but it's not a consolation. Meaning, imagine living your whole life knowing that your son's going to suffer what you should have really got. Very difficult. Perspective to live with. Rak es kol ha-memlocho lo yekra, and again, another consolation. I'm not going to tear away the whole kingship like Hashem did by Shaul. Shevet echad etein ivnecho. I'm going to give you one tribe left. Leman David Avdi, because of David my servant. Uleman Yerushalayim asher bachartim, because of Jerusalem which I have chosen. Fascinating. So this is really just fascinating perspective. What's going on over here? Why is it? Why is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is sparing him? So the Balbim says, interestingly enough, we go back to source 3. The Balbim says, Leman David Avecha, Ze yuvan apim asher bi'arti, she'ashem nasana malchus livnoi shel David b'loi t'nai. We know that when David HaMelech was promised the kingdom, he was promised it to his children unconditionally. When David HaMelech said, remember, if we go back to Shmuel Beis, Perek Ches, David HaMelech wanted to build the Beis Zvinash, HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Nasan HaNavi to tell him, no, you're not going to build it, but I will give it to your son. And that was without condition. Ah, but it came to his grandchildren. That was conditional. That he said, I'm not going to go back from you, but there is, depends on your children. If your children do my commandment, my covenant, if they keep my covenant, they will ultimately have the kingship for longevity. In Cain, So to a certain degree, Shlomo HaMelech was untouchable because of the initial covenant given to David, but his children were more vulnerable. I will add to this, though, that when we studied this a little bit earlier, when we saw some of the conditions, remember on David HaMelech's deathbed when he spoke to Shlomo HaMelech, and we compare that to the promise given to David HaMelech in the first place, we saw that there seems to be two degrees of the promise. The first degree is that on the most basic level, Malchus is never going to leave the house of David. But on the other hand, there seems to be the success of that kingship and what that's going to look like. What about other people who will also be kings? And that may depend on the actions of the children and the grandchildren of David HaMelech. And so what we're seeing over here is that even though it's going to be ripped away, first of all, it's going to be spared the first generation, and then it's also going to be spared it's not that it's going to be taken fully away, it's just going to be supplanted to a certain degree. There's going to be another king ruling at the same time. And that also is as a function of that initial promise to David HaMelech. I want to skip this midrash for just a moment and just focus on an interesting perspective, a theological perspective that the Ralbag shares here. The Ralbag, on the commenting on the same thing that Malim just said, says an interesting thing, and this is something worthwhile chewing on, trying to understand what this means. He says in source 6, L'man David Avdi, Magid Shemeha Hashkacha Al Ha'av Timoshech Leben. That the way that the Hashem has providence of the father will continue to the child. L'man David Avdo Yishkiach B'Shlomo Shlo Yikra Dava Mimamlacha Mimenu B'Chayav U'l'man David Avdo Yishkiach B'Zera Shlomo Shlo Tosur Mimenu Hamamlacha Legamrei. So what this means is that because David HaMelech was a worthy king, therefore ultimately his children would also be in that same, under the same sunshine, so to speak. They would be benefiting from the same treatment that David HaMelech was deserving. And there's something fascinating about this, you know, because this is very true in so many ways. Just a basic example, without using the word hashkacha. What happens if parents make a decision, they're going to send their children, and they're going to, you know, scrimp and save, and they feel that their children need a better education, be it Torah education, secular education, havdil, and they decide that they're going to invest a lot in their children's education. Or they have a choice between two neighborhoods, and they say, you know, this neighborhood is cheaper, it's easier, but that if we just, you know, put a little bit less, we're going to go on less vacations, and we'll be in a different neighborhood where we feel the influences will be better for our children. Those decisions that parents make, and certainly in the critical days of their children's development, are going to have impact on their children. And that's not a woo-woo kind of, like, you know, spiritual metaphysical idea. That's simply educationally, the decisions that parents make will ultimately impact their children. And children certainly don't have the opportunity of making many decisions in their life, certainly not up to the age of high school. So a lot of it is they are beneficiaries, or in fact, they're going to be the outcome of their parents' decisions. That's on a, we'll call it, psychological level. And the Ralbag is taking that further, and he's saying to the same degree that it works psychologically and socially, environmentally, it also works spiritually as well. That means to say that the way that David HaMelech lived his life had an influence on those children to such a degree that to a certain degree they were impervious of full rejection. That's a remarkable thing. That is a very hopeful idea to try to think about, that what a parent can do can give certain immunity to their children from the problems they may have in their future. That's a very beautiful idea. So he looks at it a little bit differently to the Malbim, and that the Malbim says it was a fine print, whereas the Ralbag says it's the continued hashkacha. Now, after finishing these psukim, we've looked at seven psukim together right now together. So what is your impression? You know, like, meaning at this point in time. So Shlomo HaMelech, good, bad, or neutral, right? So after reading these psukim, I mean, I don't know. It's very hard to find many excuses for this at this point in time. It's very hard to say, oh, you know, it was a mistake. It wasn't really mean it. You know, it was it wasn't as said. I mean, it seems to me, just from reading these psukim, first time around, this does not seem very favorable for Shlomo HaMelech, who we love dearly. So how does this work? So it's interesting that this is one of the occasions, and I think this is an important methodological point for us to dwell on for just a few minutes, is the way that Chazal treat this. So Chazal take this, and I feel like sometimes we read this Gemara, and we feel like the rug's been taken out from under us, and it really diminishes our perspective of Chazal. And that's why it's really worthwhile specifically now to take a look at this Gemara. Actually just passed it recently, just a few weeks ago in Shabbos. Shabbos Daf Nun Vav Min Aleph. It's a famous Gemara, and here's the part of it that we're going to be studying. Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yonasan. So Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni said in the name of Rabbi Yonasan, Call Ha'amer Shlomo Chato, Eino Ela Toe. A person who says Shlomo Melech sinned, mistaken. Just don't know how to read Tanakh. Shneimar, V'lohayolo V'voy Shlomim Ima Hashem Elokov, Kilavav David. His heart wasn't pure with David. Kilavav David Aviv, who deloy Havo, Michta Namilo Chato. So what does it say? It says he wasn't really as good as his father. It doesn't say he was bad, terrible, evil. It just says that he wasn't as good as his father. So he didn't sin. So the Gemara says, wait a second. Let's not micro focus. Let's not stick with one pasuk and say, you know, okay, I'm going to build my edifice and my thesis based on one pasuk. That would be intellectually inappropriate. We just read, you know, that this is what we learned last week, that his wives tilted his heart. They diverted his perspective. No, there's another way of interpreting that pasuk. Pasuk Dalet. What is it? To Rabbi Nosson Rame. Rabbi Nosson brings a contradiction. It says on the one hand that at his old age, his wives tilted his heart or twisted his heart away. But on the other hand, it says that he wasn't like, quite like his father, implying that he wasn't bad, he just wasn't brilliant. But he didn't sin. So in resolving this, Rabbi Nosson would say, his wives went after these gods, but he himself did not go after them. It's implying that they went after them. Let's read all the pasukim we just read in a few minutes ago. That seems to be pretty unequivocally, unadulteratedly, unexcusably a sacrifice for a altar for a foreign god. So the Gemara says, no, shibikesh livnos ulebara. He wanted to, but he didn't. So at this point in time, we're thinking, okay, the poetic license sounds a little stretched right now. Let's try to put this all back together. So let's read the other psukim in Tanakh, says the Gemara. Let's be honest. And the rest of Tanakh, we talk about people who built a bama for, and in this case, it was well meant by Yahushua for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're going to say, no, he really didn't mean it. He was trying to, he didn't get there. Of course he meant that he built it. So yeah, we should also say that. It must be like the Brisa teaches, Rabbi Yossi Omer, rather, it is meant to be understood like Rabbi Yossi, that it describes all these other, that Rabbi Yossi talked about, there were all these other bamos, which were built by Shlomo around Yerushalayim. And this is a pasuk much later on in Melachim Beis Chof Gimel, the very, very end. At the end of the whole period of Melachim. Efshar ba'asa v'loi bi'aram? Yehoshaphat v'loi bi'aram? What are you talking about? You have all these altars to all these pagan gods around Jerusalem. And these well-intended kings like Asa and Yehoshaphat, who really were good kings on the whole. It took Yoshiyahu to destroy them. No one else throughout all Jewish history in Judea had thought to destroy this. So clearly it can't be as interpreted. We have psukim to indicate that these interleading kings, who are kings of the south, destroyed all Avodah Zorah. No, there's a connection between the first and the last. What does that mean? So what we're referring to over here is that the earlier ones, what is referred to by the earlier ones, the destruction of altars, one second, how does this work? So in the end, the bamos which were built towards the end, we know, were not built. Nevertheless, they were depended or they were attributed to, meaning later on at the times of Yoshiyahu, when they all these altars that were destroyed were done by the predecessors of Yoshiyahu, but nonetheless he was given the credit of doing it. So too, when it came to Shlomo Melech, he didn't build the Bama, but because it was under his purview and his rule, it was attributed to him. Says he did evil in the eyes of Hashem. So the Gemara says we've almost interpreted this. It means because his wives sinned, and went wayward in the service of all these different pagan entities, and he did not put his foot down. That's why it's as if he sinned. Fascinating. Fascinating whole description that is going on over here. Let's try to put this into perspective. You know, sometimes when you hear a Gemara like this, you walk away, and unfortunately I've heard people, and I'm sure we feel the sentiment that Chazal are whitewashing something which went on. Really, let's just be honest. Let's be honest with ourselves and understand that Shlomo HaMelech sins. And why is that we need to always euphemize what went on? So that's sometimes the feeling we get out of when we come out of these Gemaras. Why is that? Why do they deviate from what seems to be the textual posterity? That's the question that I like to try to address. In fact, when it comes to this, most of the Mepharshim adopt this. So as an example, in Halacha, here's the way that the Rambam codifies in Halacha. He's talking about the Halachas of Isarabia, forbidden relationships, and he says the following in the 13th chapter. Al yale adhad choshishim shalom oshiyas Yisrael, or Shlomo Melech Yisrael, shenikra yadid Hashem, nosu noshim nochriyaz begiyusam. Don't think that Shlomo Melech married a non-Jewish woman in her non-Jewish state. Elo, Sona Devar, Kahu, this all must have happened. Shamitzah Nachonash, Keshi Yavor, Gager, or Gioris, Iskayer, Bodkina Harov, Shema Biglal, Mamono, or Shiital, Oy Bishvil, Sororo, Shiizkilo, Oy Mibne Pahapachad, Bodikonizadas. Maybe they had ulterior motives. Maybe it was money, maybe it was power, maybe it was escaping persecution. Maybe those are the reasons why they joined this enterprise called Judaism. If it's a man who's converting, you want to see, is he converting because he found a pretty Jewish girl? Or maybe if it's a woman, maybe she found a handsome young Jewish man. So we don't want it to be that their adherence and attachment to Judaism is dependent on something, contingent upon a person, contingent upon an idea. Im lo nimtza lahem ila, moedi'in oisam koiver ala Torah, if we find there's no ulterior motives, then we tell them a little bit of the gravity of taking not upon themselves the Torah, and we're going to skip to the end of the halacha. He says, "Lefichach, lo kiblu based in gerim kol yemei David uShlomo b'mei David shema mina pachar chazru." So they didn't accept any gerim in the times of David and Shlomo. Why? Because in the times of David, what's the reason why people were flocking to become Jews? Because or Israelites at that point in time, because Israel was the military powerhouse in the Middle East. They didn't want to get persecuted, so they thought, well, if we convert or we pretend to convert, we might escape persecution. Maybe in Shlomo, because it was a good part economically. Look, this is the best nation to be part of, so maybe we can convert then. Says the Rambam, a person who converts for these exterior ulterior motives are not considered righteous converts. There were those who set up their own individual abate dinim. By the way, it sounds like shtiblach, right? You know, there's the centralized movement in Judaism and based in says, you know, we do this, and people have their own plans. They think that they know better, right? So they're gonna do their own thing. We'll do a side job. So based in didn't force them against them because they did do tefillah and they did accept mitzvahs. Well, if yishagiyur shlomash nashim v'nasam v'chein nimshach shimshon giyur v'nasam. Since they married and converted these people, and we know that they really married because of a lot of them because of exterior motives, and they weren't done through the rabbanut, so to speak. So to a certain degree, they remained their identity, their cultural identity remained to be part of the nations around them. And in the end, history proves us right. So in the end of the day, they served all the Avodah Zarah, and it was attributed to Shlomo HaMelech because he allowed this to happen. He allowed these people to have these illegitimate conversions at a time when it shouldn't have been happening. So the Rambam is adopting wholeheartedly the narrative of the Gemara, which is that Shlomo HaMelech, it wasn't that Shlomo HaMelech was serving Avodah Zarah. It wasn't as if Shlomo HaMelech built this bama to serve Avodah Zarah. No, he allowed them under his purview to do this. And this is the sin. So the question really comes back is how is this possible? How is this possible? Why would that Chazal seem to go against the basic reading of the text? And so for this, we're not going to read in Saba. I did put a little bit of the Abarbanel at the end over here, and it's really, really beautiful, beautiful essay he has on this. And Abarbanel is not shy to look at all the Mefarshim and to look at Chazal and to go off on his own tangent. He's the Abarbanel numerous times across Tanakh. Rejects all the Mefarshim, sometimes has different perspectives to Chazal's perspective. He has a very, very creative way of looking at things. But when it comes to this, and I will also point out that the Radak and the Ralbag and all the other Mefarshim who may sometimes deviate from Chazal's drash when it comes to certain things, all line up here and they go with Chazal. Why is that? Why is that the case? So the Abarbanel has many reasons, but one of them is he says if you just read the text, it is clear that the text doesn't add up. It doesn't work. It's clear that there's something wrong over here. So as an example, first of all, he says, look, you have the wisest of all men. You have a person over here who's been endowed with godly wisdom. And you think that person who has a direct conversation with God, who builds the metaphysical structure of the house in God, is going to be, you know, at the end of his day, is going to start setting up an altar to Chemosh. It doesn't make logical sense that same person should be doing this. But if you look at the text as well, when it comes to this, he says, look, these different gods that it talks about, you know, we hear the Chittiot and the Moaviot and the Ammoniot and Chemosh and Baal, all these people, they're not compatible. It wasn't as if one pantheon agreed with another pantheon. There were different nations and they're different gods. No one person would be serving all the gods. It doesn't make sense. There was no one person serving all the gods. If we're hearing about Shlomo HaMelech serving all these gods, it's an indication that it's clearly not him serving them, but rather individuals who must be serving each of those individual gods. Who are those people? It must be his wives. If you look at the text of the Psukim as well, very carefully, you'll see that this seems to be clearly indicated. So as an example, here we are. Let's look at the Bama that he built in Pasuk Zion again. He built this altar, Lichmosh Shikutz Moav. So he builds this, right? So that ostensibly sounds like he makes this. So it says that he's building this altar, but the altar's to two gods. So that's the first of all red flag. How could the altar be the two gods have two different ways of service? Number one. Number two is V'chein asa, and so he did. So now at this point in the sentence, you'd say, okay, well, that means that he got out the bricks and the rocks and he made an altar for them. No, but listen to the end of the pasuk. They were serving their gods. So who's doing it? Is it them or is it him? And that's exactly where Chazal enter. And they say, look, there's two subjects to the sentence. There's Shlomo and then there's them. There's two attributions. They're maktiros u'mezabchos. And it says, v'chein asa, and so he did. Which is it? So what Chazal is saying is there seems to be an internal contradiction over here in reading this psukim. The only reason why it says Zachen Asa is because it's as if he did because of what they're doing, which is Maktiros Mezabchos Lelohehen. And that's why it is. And the psukim, when they castigate Shlomo HaMelech, for almost all the psukim that are castigated Shlomo HaMelech, what does it say? Is Kinotah Levavoyim Ima Sheolake Yisrael, because his heart turned away from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hanira El Abigivon. Pamaim. Wait a second. His heart turned away. He sinned. He was evil. He turned his back. He rejected. He flushed. There's other words to describe rejection of God. That does not sound like he's rejecting God right now. This sounds like he didn't live up to David HaMelech, right? In the later psukim, it says that what? And he says, because you didn't keep my covenant as I expected of David HaMelech. It should say, you know what? You rejected HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You start serving other gods. This is a transgression of the second of the Aseres HaDibros. But that doesn't know what it says. It says, you know what? You didn't live up to the way David HaMelech. Your heart wasn't full with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's clear the Pesukim are indicating, but then why is the Pesukim maligning Shlomo HaMelech as if he made it himself? So Gemara says, because it's considered the fact that he left this happen. He allowed this to unfold under his own purview. It was what is ultimately attributed to him. So the Ralbag says a similar thing, which means to say that sometimes we have a little bit of humility when reading these Pesukim. It's very easy to focus on one Pesuk or one phrase within a Pesuk and say, oh, this must be what it's about. And what Chazal are teaching us is that with a more sensitive reading of these psukim, we can get a sense of what's really going on, the complexities of what really happened, and what's attributed to be happening. When you're a big leader, you take a lot of blame, even for the things that you don't do necessarily do. One thing that is worthwhile noting is, when did this all happen? This happened in his old age. It could well have been that he married these women many years beforehand. And it could have been that everything was fine and all right until a little bit later on, and when he was a little less powerful, and they were able to perform an axis with perhaps within his own household, and they said, you know, wouldn't it be fine if? That's when things started to go turning south. Complexities over here, the complexity of responsibility of Shlomo HaMelech, and try to understand this Gemara. It is interesting that almost unilaterally, all Mepharshim across the board adopt this Chazal as Pshat, not Drash, which means to say that they understand that this is what's going on actually in Shlomo HaMelech's life. With this, we're just going to close this, and now we have the opportunity of seeing the dissidents who arrive. Who is it that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to use? And there's a few people that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to use as pawns in this chess match, so to speak, of putting Shlomo HaMelech back into his place, the complexity that's going to arise in just a few moments. In the meantime, I hope this is a fascinating, thought-provoking idea to think about.